The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Liz Elliott from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, May 2019, Volume 20, Number 5. This is the fourth of five installments of the May issue. On the front cover this month, Oprah is pictured against a white background. She's got on a magenta, self-belted sweater dress that comes down just past her knees. It's slightly off the shoulder, and she's accessorized her dress this month with a pair of bright orange pumps with pointed toes and a pair of earrings that drop down from her ears with magenta stones in it. Her arms are wide open. She has a big smile on her face, and her hair is blowing in the breeze. And she's holding a big white O in her right hand. It's the Oprah logo. It's almost a perfect circle with a big oval opening in the center. And that white O is held against an orange square in the top left-hand corner of the magazine. And that orange square coordinates with Oprah's shoes. She looks very, very happy. Big smile on her face. Wavy hair blowing in the breeze. And the quote on the front of the May issue is, "It's possible to have many mothers. There's the one who gave birth to you, and then there are all the women who raised you up." For our first section this month, we're going to move to the Live Your Best Life section of Oprah Magazine. And in this installment, we are going to read an article entitled, "You Do You." There's a hip-hop headquarters within Harvard's ivy-covered walls, and it's overseen by Marcelena Morgan, Ph.D. In the early 1990s, I was teaching a linguistic anthropology course at UCLA. For one assignment, I asked students to analyze a speech community, or a group that shares attitudes about language use and practices. A number of them wanted to focus on hip-hop, but at the time, I didn't see hip-hop as a culture. A few days later, about 15 students came into my office with a presentation on hip-hop's elements, its poetry, its wordplay, the underground society it had created. They opened my eyes to the fact that hip-hop wasn't necessarily profane, misogynistic, or many of the other labels given to it. Rather, it's a whole worldview. A set of cultural and political beliefs and values embraced by its members who see hip-hop as a way to speak the truth. And when those students graduated, they brought me albums, magazines, posters, what anthropology calls material culture. They said things like, "My mom was going to toss these, but we know you won't because you're an anthropologist, and anthropologists don't throw away material culture." They were right. In 2002, when I started teaching at Harvard, I brought these items with me and established the Hip Hop Archive and Research Institute. The archive feels like hip hop, but it also feels like Harvard. That's thanks to 20 students who thought about and debated how the space should look. Outside, there's a large black and white image of two female MCs rapping, as well as photos of Grandmaster Flash, Missy Elliott, and other hip hop founders and legends. Inside, like any other serious space at Harvard, it's filled with artifacts, copies of Vibe magazine, Run DMC action figures, slip-on vans with Tupac Shakur's face, music videos on TV screens, turntables, and, of course, records from artists like the notorious B.I.G. and Jay-Z. One of my biggest challenges is getting people to recognize hip-hop as intellectually significant. Rather than look at the genre through the lens of one artist or song, think of it as a global and complex culture that values innovation and authenticity. It's done more to crystallize urban African-American youth identity than any other recent political or societal change. At the same time, I've seen white donors come here and get teary because hip-hop dance gave their daughters, who were bullied, the confidence to get through high school. People listen to this music to hear their own story to hear someone talk about making it through a hard life, whether that's been raised in poverty or a home where they were ignored. Hip-hop tells people from all walks of life that they're not alone. Just below the end of this article, there's a little section called Quick Studies, and it has a peek inside other captivating university archives. And there's a picture of a Rubik's Cube, and beneath that it says, "The Jerry Slocum Mechanical Puzzle Collection at Indiana University." Tinkerers will love this archive's 30,000 plus puzzles, all of which require physical manipulation to be solved. For more than 80 years, puzzle enthusiast Jerry Slocum gathered IQ testers like tangrams, wooden polyhedrons, circular mazes, and Rubik's cubes, plus their predecessors and imitators, from Germany, Taiwan, the Netherlands, and the U.S. Smart moves! Beside that, there's a picture of a book entitled Dick Gregory's Natural Diet for Folks Who Eat, Cooking with Mother Nature. And below that says the David Walker Lupton African American Cookbook Collection at the University of Alabama. These 450 volumes aren't just recipe collections. They're windows onto African American history and culture. Revealing reads include The House Servants Directory, published in 1827, Book of Molasses Magic from 1956, Northern Fried Chicken, A Historical Adventure into the Black Community of Scranton, Pennsylvania from 1993, and yes, Cookin' with Coolio from 2009. And on that note, we will head to the Let's Eat section to cover another page. On this one, there's a picture of a big yellow background and three plates covered with tacos with a little strip of fried fish. And it looks like a white cream sauce, some greenery, and some red peppers, and a few limes scattered around. And the title at the top says, Fast or Fancy, Fish Tacos. Cinco de Mayo calls for tacos, and this fresh bread from Justin Chapel, author of Just Cook It, is a guaranteed seafood fiesta. Chapel's pan-fried swordfish tacos feature a zippy herb medley that lets the meaty seafood sing. Here's the recipe for fish stick tacos with herb salad. Mix four servings, total time 30 minutes. In a shallow bowl, spread 1 cup of all-purpose flour. In another, beat 3 large eggs with a pinch of kosher salt. In a third, spread 2 cups of panko breadcrumbs and season to taste with salt and ground black pepper. Season 2 8-ounce, half-inch thick, skinless swordfish steaks. Cut into 1-inch wide sticks with salt and pepper to taste. Dredge sticks in flour. Dip in egg, allowing the excess to drip off. Coat in panko and transfer to a plate. In a large skillet over medium-high heat, pour 1/4-inch canola oil in warm until shimmering. Add fish sticks and fry, turning once until browned and cooked through, about 5 minutes. Transfer to a paper towel-lined plate to drain and season lightly with salt. Meanwhile, in a medium bowl, toss 1.5 cups cilantro leaves, lightly packed, 3/4 cup roughly chopped chives, 3/4 cup of roughly chopped dill, 1 jalapeno, halved and very thinly sliced, 2.5 tablespoons of lime juice from about 1 medium lime, and 1.5 tablespoons of oil. Season with salt and pepper to taste. On 12 corn tortillas, warmed, spread sour cream and top with fish sticks and herb salad. Serve with lime wedges. And if you're not a fish stick fan, load your tortillas with popcorn shrimp or chicken fingers instead. And there's a little section off to the side with a picture of 2 fish sticks and a beautiful bowl, a green salad, and a little bottle of hot sauce. And it says, talk about easy. Baked frozen fish sticks make a fine filling, and you'll get plenty of tang and heat if you top your tacos with shredded mixed cabbage, you know, the kind you buy for coleslaw, sour cream, and hot sauce. And now we're going to head to Adam's Style Sheet. Creative Director Adam Glassman is here to help you breeze through spring looking professional yet feeling comfortable. And in the center of the page, front and center, there is a double-breasted tailored white blazer. The sleeves have a little ruching. They look to be about a three-quarter length. And right at the top of the ruching on the outside of the wrist, there is a little knot with a beautiful little tail on it. And the lining of the blazer is pink. And the buttons are a mother-of-pearl material with a little bit of a pink cast, and they are stitched to the jacket with what looks to be a rose pink thread. And in the caption, it says, jacket required. Ties at the sleeves add a fresh, feminine twist to a structured blazer. Tailored Rebecca Taylor, $495, Nordstrom.com. And in the top right-hand corner of the page, there is a blue shoulder bag with a blue strap and silver-toned accents. That caption reads, has it all handbag. This go-to work bag with exterior and interior pockets can carry a day's worth of stuff, even a tablet. And its two straps allow for crossbody or shoulder wear. $238, VeraBradley.com. Below that is a pair of khaki pants. They have a slim waistline with no belt loops, slash pockets on the front, and they're a pale khaki color. And the caption says, kick in the pants. Perfect for casual Fridays and beyond. These chinos with technology that lifts the rear and slims the tummy, and a stretchy fabric that keeps its shape, won't fall down on the job. $119, NYDJ.com. Below that is a knee-length yellow floral dress. It has three-quarter of length sleeves with ties at the bottom of the sleeve and a yellow and white floral pattern. Its caption reads, dress to impress. No springtime work wardrobe is complete without the cheeriness of a floral frock. This sunny shift is from Kohl's new brand, EVRI, which offers clothing in sizes 14W to 30W and 0X to 4X. $56, Kohl's.com. Below that is a white button-down shirt, and the bottom of the sleeves, from about the elbow length down, are pink. And the caption reads, haute button. An extra set of concealed buttons on the inside placket of this shirt brings gaping to a close. $148, 13-7.com. And to the left of that, in the center of the page, pictured slightly larger, are three pairs of shoes. The first is a silver ballet flat with a nice orthopedic leather lining. The back of the ballet flat has a little bit of ruching right around the heel. Looks like the heel stretches to go around. The center pair is a pink suede pair of loafers. And across the vamp of the loafers are silver stones, silver rhinestones. And the third pair is a pair of ballet flats with a small heel. They're very pale pink. There seems to be a strap crossing the top of the foot and wrapping around the heel. And right across the toe of the shoe, there is a little bit of gathered pleated leather there. And the caption reads, feel good flats. With a clean, classic design and six color choices, this ballet flat goes with everything from jeans to dresses, plus has cushioning, arch support, and an elastic back to prevent slippage. $100, fitflop.com. Sure, this loafer may have orthotic level support, but the sparkly embellishment and soft pink suede jazz up any pants look. Vionic, $140, vionicshoes.com. Cozy features like a super flexible sole, shock absorption, and a cushy memory foam footbed will help guide you through the workday. $275, taranrose.com. And our final picture has three blouses folded in a paper-lined box, like a gift box. The first blouse is a soft, iridescent, shimmery gold silk, and it is laying on top of a white blouse with tan stripes, and that is laying on top of a black blouse. And the caption reads, "In rotation, popular workwear brand Vince now has a monthly subscription service that lets you rent up to 4 items at a time, from blouses to skirts, with the option to buy what you like at a reduced price. $160 per month, VinceUnfold.com. Now we'll take a look at Adam's pet style sheet, pastel picks for putting some spring in your furry friend's step. Right at the top of the page, there is a tote bag with a little cutout on the right side. There's a multicolored pattern on the inside of the tote bag in pastels. And the bottom of the tote bag and the handles and the piping around the edge are turquoise. And it says, "Lair of the Dog. Oh Joy Geometric Pet Tote. $50. OhJoy.com/Petco. To the right of that, there is a cardboard triangle, and the very edge of the triangle has a turquoise and white, kind of a geometric pattern. And it says, "Claw to the Top, Boots and Barkley Triangle Cat Scratcher, $20, Target.com. Beneath that, there is a bone made of braided black and pink quartz. And it says, "Play It Cool, Braided Bone Toy, $17, TallTalesDog.com. Below that, there is a floral dog collar, has a peach background, darker peach flowers with black and blue and orange leaves, a very modern floral pattern. It has gold accents on the collar tightener. There's a gold leash attachment, and the closure to the collar is gold. It reads, "Best Buds, Rosa Floral Natural Dog Collar, $32, thefoggydog.com. Below that, there's a candle tin. The background is pink. It has beautiful purple writing on it, Leela Ryan, Boutique Dog Treats. And there's a little label on the candle that says Red Velvet Cake. Sweet deal. 10 of Red Velvet Cake vegan dog biscuits, $15, LeelaRyan.com. That's LeelaRyan.com. Next to that, there's a small turquoise pagoda with a white cushion inside of it. It's open on all sides, and just inside there's a little brown puppy. And the caption reads, "Pawgoda, J.M. Pierce Dog Bed, $1,500, yourhomedecor.com. And that's spelled E-U-R-E, homedecor.com. To the left of that, there's a ceramic cookie jar. And the top of it is yellow. There's a little yellow handle on the top. And the body of the jar is painted turquoise and yellow stripes. And there's a little yellow dog bone on a white background. And it says, "Bone Home. Mint Color Block Dog Bone Canister, $40. CotonColors.com. That's CotonColors.com. Above that is a small blue pet bowl with a white interior. And in the white interior, right in the center of the bowl, there's a raised white heart shape. It says, "Scruff Love, Majiso Small Pet Bowl, $30, Bloomingdales.com. And finally on the page, there is a pink leash with a yellow handle. And there's a little blue part on the leather that holds the little clip that fastens to the leash. Max Bone Isabel Leash, $95 for thefurry.com. And that's Adam's style sheet for both people and pets for the May issue of Oprah. Now we're going to move to the O list, and we've been reading the O Beauty Awards this month. Now there's a feature page with just cosmetics. The top of the page says cosmetics, and it says create a little makeup magic with these standout selections that suit natural women and drama queens alike. And in the center of the page, there is a whole bunch of powder foundation compacts. They're all gold with an L logo on the front for Estee Lauder. They're all standing open. They're all stacked on top of each other, all messy. There's no order to it. And inside each compact is a different color foundation. And the caption says, Estee Lauder Double Wear Stay in Place Matte Powder Foundation. Foundation that retains its shine-free finish for up to 12 hours and doesn't feel stiff? No, it's not an impossible dream. The flexible, lightweight formulation of this oil-free powder doesn't cake or crack and is resistant to humidity and perspiration. $42 each, EsteeLauder.com. And here is their list of standout cosmetics. Number 1, lip gloss. NARS Multi-Use Gloss. Add these 5 colorful glosses to your beauty arsenal and you'll be the ultimate mix master. In hues including pewter, gold, and rose, they work on their own or blended with other products to add dimension and shine to lids, lips, and cheekbones. $24 each, NARSCosmetics.com. Number 2, primer. Ole Henriksen Banana Bright Face Primer. To give your complexion a glowing finish before you put on a drop of makeup, try this lightweight formula, which is also loaded with vitamin C and D. $36, Sephora.com. Number 3, eyeliner. CoverGirl Get In Line Active Liquid Liner. Even if you don't wear makeup to the gym, it's hard to deny the appeal of a liner that doesn't budge for up to 24 hours. Waterproof and sweatproof, this high-impact formula delivers rich color, whether you're doing subtle definition or all-out smoky. $9.50 each, drugstores. Number 4, brow. Maybelline New York Tattoo Studio Brow Pomade. This waterproof, no-smudge matte formula fills and sets sparse brows for lush-looking arches that last. $10 each, drugstores. Number 5, multi-use. Lancôme Le Monochromatique. A finger-friendly, cream-to-powder tint that works on eyes, lips, and cheeks to impart a subtle flush of color in pearl or matte finishes. $25 each, Lancôme-USA.com. 6. Loose Powder. Stila In The Buff Powder Spray. Setting powder that comes in a no-mess, perfectly portable mist? Why didn't we think of that? Now you can keep makeup in place with a simple spritz of this super fine, oil-absorbing wonder to get a look that lasts for hours. $30 each, StilaCosmetics.com. Number 7, eyeshadow. Christian Louboutin Top Alloyal Eye Colors. Whether your tastes run toward nude or jewel tones, you'll find something to love among this offering of creamy liquid shadows. Available in 6 matte neutrals and 6 sparkling metallic finishes, the lightweight formula won't crease or smudge. $50 each, ChristianLouboutin.com. Number 8, mascara. Pat McGrath Labs Fetishize Mascara. Model tested on runways from Prada to Versace, this blacker-than-black mascara turns wimpy lashes into showstoppers, delivering the ultimate in lift, length, and volume. And with its blend of peptides and panthenol, it ensures your fringe stays strong and soft, even after you've wiped the formula off. $28, PatMcGrath.com. Number 9, lip liner. Becca Ultimate Lip Definer. Nothing creates a perfectly crisp lip line like a pencil. This one comes in 18 waterproof shades, from baby pink to vibrant red to rich brown. So it works under lipstick or on its own. $18 each, Ulta.com. And on the right-hand side of the page, there's a picture of a lady at the top. She's got dark hair, dark skin, and a magenta lip shade on. She's got a blue off-the-shoulder dress with a ruffle just around her upper arm. And below it, it says, "What does beauty mean to you?" Her answer is, "It means loving myself. There is nothing better than that. But it's a process. We learn to love ourselves over time. It's a day-by-day project with ups and downs. It feels so good to look in the mirror and say to yourself, 'I'm an amazing woman.' You eventually start seeing yourself as one and feeling like one, too. When it comes to my look, I love wearing backless tops and blouses with a boat neck. Clothes that show off the unique beauty of my skin." And that's Beatrice from Brazil. When we turn the page, about three-quarters of the page from top to bottom is taken up with many tubes of Bobbi Brown lip gloss in all different shades. The top of each tube is red, and there's a pink shade and a vibrant red shade, an earthy red, a baby pink, a peachy color, a more of a rose pink, several different shades of red, and the caption says, "Reader, rave. I just lost my favorite pink lipstick, but as soon as I got the Bobbi Brown Crushed Liquid Lip and Peach and Quiet, I realized I found an even better replacement. The color is soft, yet vibrant, and it looks like a gloss with the long-lasting pigment of a lipstick." And on the right-hand side of this page, there's another column that asks, "What does beauty mean to you?" And at the top, there's a lovely lady with a smile on her face. Her skin is darker, and all of her dark hair is coiled up into braids and a bun up on the top of her head. She's wearing an off-white coat, and she's got a hot pink bag thrown over her shoulder. There's a scarf with dark blue and off-white stripes with a blue pattern and a brown, and she's got a light blue earring to coordinate with her scarf. And her answer to the question is, "Beauty is the way a person takes care of her soul. It comes from the inside. When you feel good, when you eat well, when you do things you enjoy and lead the life you want, you shine and inspire people. I think beauty reflects a peaceful and loving heart. I used to have a complex about the gap in my teeth and my dark skin. Over the years, I've learned how to reject people's negative comments, sometimes from close friends, ex-boyfriends, even relatives. And I love myself as I am. That is beauty." And that's Virginie from France. And now we'll head away from the O list and head over to the reading room. The front page of the reading room section this month is a picture that is very reminiscent of a Japanese woodblock print style. And in the center are two girls, and they seem to be swimming in the air almost. They have black shorts and white button-down long-sleeve shirts on. Below them, in the distance, are a group of men, and they're surrounded by young boys and holding babies. And the entire picture is surrounded by a turquoise wave. And scattered all over the place in the picture are little yellow schools of fish and army green bomber planes. And the caption reads, "Into the Deep, an enthralling novel reimagines a once thriving matriarchy." Off the coast of South Korea lies Jeju, known as Island of the Gods, where women were once the breadwinners, fish winners. Meet the Hyun Yeo, the guild of female divers who spend their days underwater searching for food to harvest and sell. They might sound like the stuff of myth, but since the 17th century, real-life Hyun Yeo have held their breath and plumbed the seas, fighting off octopuses, sharks, and abalones. Meanwhile, their husband stayed home and tended to chores and children. The Hainyeo, nearly extinct today, are the enigmatic protagonist of Lisa C's latest, The Island of Sea Women, published by Scribner. As in The Shanghai Girls and other previous works, C ventures to East Asia to revisit a female-centric story largely lost to time. As formidable as the Hainyeo were, C found, they couldn't fend off outside incursion. The novel explores the ways global forces poked holes into the Jeju idol. At one point, Japanese colonists try to encourage the men of Jeju to do as we do, keep your women at home. In a plot that dips back and forth between the recent and distant past, C follows the life of her iron-willed heroine, Young Suk. It's 2008 when we meet her. By then, she's in her 80s. Battered by decades of exposure to the sea, and Jeju is no longer the unblemished oasis of 70 years earlier, when Young Suk and her first, fiercest friend, Mi Ja, were baby divers, braving frigid temperatures and lightweight cotton suits and using gourds as buoys. Young Suk reflects on the trajectory of their friendship and on the history they witnessed, how the two grew from tentative girls to women with children of their own, in the process of enduring the region's darkest moments, from colonial rule to World War II and the Korean conflict. A mid-century massacre obliterates much of Young Suk's family, as a betrayal by Mi Ja severs their previously unbreakable bond. In an author's note, C explains a few of the artistic choices she's made, such as occasionally interspersing the text with local vernacular. On Jeju, the word for goddess, Halmang, is the same as the one for grandmother, she observes, which makes sense given the way the women were revered. Grandmother Somonde, the creator goddess, assessed how deep the waters were before the Hainyeo went in. She tested herself in many ways, as all women must, Young Suk learns. And that's a story that's universal. The next section is titled Ain't Love Grand. A game-changing young author solidifies her spot in the vanguard. Connell and Marianne, the teenage paramours at the heart of Normal People, published by Hogarth, Irish author Sally Rooney's exquisite second novel, pretend not to know each other in the hallways at school. He's the in-demand jock. She's the reticent bookworm. But he's also the son of her cleaning lady, a situation that leads them to keep their budding relationship hush hush. Their furtiveness binds them intensely together. Marianne's gaze feels to Connell like looking in a mirror, seeing something that has no secrets from you. Yet the deep affection they share can't quite conquer the social divide. We follow their on-again, off-again relationship over the course of 4 years, through high school and college, from small-town County Sligo to cosmopolitan Dublin, as they fall in love and fall apart. Rooney's much-adored 2017 debut, Conversations with Friends, heralded the then-26-year-old as a fully formed novelist, able to marry archetypal storytelling with strikingly modern sensibilities. Her canonical come contempo style employs elegantly unvarnished prose to elucidate messy feelings. Attending a soccer match with her peers, Marianne is struck by the sense that her real life was happening somewhere very far away, happening without her, and she didn't know if she would ever find out where it was and become part of it. Despite the novel's seeming simplicity, you can't help getting caught up in its deft emotional dance. These are characters you'll worry about, root for. Both playing into and belying its title, Normal People crystallizes what makes Rooney's work so compulsively readable, turning a modest teenage relationship into an astute epic of romance and class. The next section of the reading room is entitled The Uncertainty Principle. In a cerebral novel, a woman's death upends the cosmic order of things. And now, Frudenberger's radiantly brainy, lost and wanted. A renowned MIT professor learns that an intense, long-standing attachment shares a topsy-turvy kinship with space-time and quantum physics. When the novel begins, 40-something Helen, in the midst of peer-reviewing an article on subatomic particles, receives news that her best friend, Charlotte, also known as Charlie, an unaccomplished actress and producer she met as an undergrad at Harvard, has taken her own life. When an especially big star dies, Helen reflects, the resulting supernova explosion produces light across the electromagnetic spectrum. Charlie's death causes more emotional fissures than Helen anticipates, and demands she confront dark matter, the ebb and flow of new and evolving relationships, the way memory feels truer than reality, and that some phenomena can never be explained. Complicating Helen's grief is the presence of two very different romantic interests, Neil, her longtime colleague and one-time lover, and Charlie's husband, Terrence, who's adjusting to life as a widower and single father. But the novel's nucleus is the connection between Helen and Charlie. Though their bond lasted into middle age, Charlie had been an enigmatic, aloof, and in and out of touch with Helen. After Charlie's death, Helen realizes that, for once, reason alone may not explain what drew them together or why Charlie ended her life. In vivid, crisp pose, laced with a satisfying, if symbolic, dose of physics, Frudenberger asks how a scientist reckons with the inexplicable. What does it mean for a Scully-esque skeptic to encounter, say, a ghost? Yes, after Charlie dies, Helen receives texts from her friend's missing cell, and Helen's son, Jack, claims to see Charlie's apparition seated at his mother's desk. Fans of Frudenberger will spot her gravity-defying gift for transmuting a potentially dicey conceit into a heart-stopping study in grief. With emotional mass and page-turning acceleration, Lost and Wanted is a piercing meditation on the apparently immutable truths that mourning calls into question, forcing its characters and readers to wrestle with one of Einstein's theories. The distinction between past, present, and future is only a stubbornly persistent illusion. And now we will leave the reading room and move to one of the feature articles entitled All Rise. Melinda Gates is using her dollars and her voice to bring about a revolution of the heart. The first call to action, she tells Oprah, is that we must break down the walls and walk through the doors together. It's impossible not to be impressed by the dedication mega philanthropist Bill and Melinda Gates have shown in their efforts to eradicate inequality and the effects of poverty. But until I read The Moment of Lift, Melinda Gates's wake-up call in book form, I didn't fully grasp the depth of their knowledge and their passion, not to mention what it took for Melinda to go from wife, mom, and concerned private citizen to one of the world's leading advocates for female empowerment. Many of the stories Melinda relates are about the people she's met in her travels and how conversation accelerates change. She says that learning to feel what others feel made her see what they see. She's witnessed radical feats of resilience, kindness, and courage everywhere she's gone. Still, for all the intimacy and inspiration the book delivers, it's, at times, a sobering read. We learn that even today, more than 130 million girls don't get to attend school. Complications during pregnancy and childbirth remain the leading causes of death among girls aged 15 to 19. And while the number of people living in extreme poverty has declined, more than 700 million of us subsist on the equivalent of $1.90 per day. I had so many ahas while reading the moment of lift. I had to get out my highlighter. Then I needed to sit down face to face with the author and learn even more, which I did on a New York City stage earlier this year. Now, on the center of this page, there's a big picture in the middle, and there's a dark purple background, and you see Oprah on the right smiling and chatting with Melinda Gates. And I'll continue the article. It's an interview form. Oprah asks, "Before we get to all of the OMG moments in your book, let's address the elephant in the room. When your name is mentioned, people immediately think money. They think her problems aren't like mine because she can pay to make hers go away. Great wealth, you write, can inflate and distort your sense of self, especially if you believe that money measures merit. Is it even possible to sit in the space of so much wealth and know that to be true?" Melinda Gates answers, "I guess I just don't see myself as different from anyone else. I grew up middle class in Dallas. The whole family worked very hard to save enough to send the four of us kids to college. We knew my dad's engineer salary wasn't going to pay for all of it, so my parents started a little real estate business on the side. My siblings and I helped with stuff like cleaning houses and keeping the books. And my parents sent me to an all-girls Catholic high school where I learned about social justice, about the need to stand up for causes and principles and for those who had less than I did." Oprah asks, "You went to work at Microsoft after getting your MBA and one day found yourself seated next to Bill Gates at an event. I love that when he first asked you out, it was for a date 2 weeks from that day, and you told him that wasn't spontaneous enough for you. So he called you 2 hours later and said, 'What about tonight?' He'd met his match." Melinda Gates answers, "That, and I could beat him at math games and Clue." Oprah says, "I was struck by the fact that even before the two of you married, you were already talking about how to do something meaningful with your money." Melinda Gates answers, "Both of our families had taught us to give back. We had that in common. My mom and dad did community service through the Catholic Church, and the Gateses were active in philanthropic causes in Seattle." Oprah says, "It was on a safari to Africa in 1993 that you worked out where you would commit your resources, right?" Melinda Gates answers, "Yes, we took our first trip to Africa a few months before our wedding. Of course, we were awed by the animals and the beautiful landscape. We loved all that. But what really struck us were the human scenes. A mother who was carrying a baby in her belly, another on her back, and a pile of sticks on her head. She'd clearly been walking a long distance with no shoes, while the men we saw were wearing flip-flops and smoking cigarettes with no sticks on their head or kids at their side. We observed similar dynamics everywhere we went, and also we couldn't get over the disparity between what we were going home to and what people there were living without." Oprah says, "You write about a walk on the beach during which you decided what?" Melinda Gates answers, "That we were going to give away the vast majority of our resources to address some of the problems we'd observed." Oprah says, "When you have so much money and know there are infinite problems out there, it's easy to get overwhelmed. Especially in Africa, the temptation is just to throw up your hands. You just don't know where to begin." Melinda Gates answers, "And as you know, we're talking about vastly different countries with multiple cultures within each. Our approach was to first gather experts to advise us on the role of philanthropy. In terms of focus, what we kept coming back to was the simple fact that millions of children were dying because they were poor. Saving as many of those lives as we could became the goal. But we weren't the government. So how ambitious could we be in terms of scale, even with our billions? Where could we have the biggest impact? Coming out of the tech sector, we were drawn to the way science and innovation could make an enormous difference." Oprah asks, "How did you decide vaccines would be the cornerstone?" Melinda Gates answers, "Return on investment wise, Vaccines have a huge payoff. If you can get a vaccine in a child's arm in Africa, it can literally save his or her life. Oprah responds, "You learned it took 15 to 20 years for vaccines readily available here or in Europe, hepatitis B, for example, to make their way to Africa, and in that interval, millions died." Melinda Gates responds, "They were dying needlessly from diseases our kids don't even have to worry about or are inoculated against. If you believe, as we do, that all lives have equal value, that can't be allowed to stand." Oprah responded, "And then you tackled women's contraception." Melinda Gates responds, "The more I traveled to see how the vaccination programs were going, the more I realized that the lack of access to contraception was also a life and death issue for women and their families. In Malawi, I remember asking a young mother with small kids, 'Are you taking those beautiful children to get their shots?' 'What about my shot?' she asked me. She was talking about Depo-Provera, a birth control injection that was commonly used in Africa to prevent pregnancy, but had become very difficult to get. This came up again and again, and the more I spoke to women in Africa and parts of Asia, especially after I learned that if I wanted women to tell me what was really going on in their lives, I needed to wait for the men to go back to work in the fields and leave us to speak openly." Oprah responded, "You started asking how many of them knew someone who died giving birth." Melinda Gates says, "And usually 3/4 did. When I asked how many knew someone who'd lost a baby in the delivery process, they'd all raise their hands." Oprah says, "And many felt that continuing to have children was endangering the future of the kids they already had." Melinda Gates responds, "A woman from Niger, Sadie, told me she had 6 children. Her youngest was next to her. 'Don't you understand?' she asked, pointing to the small piece of arid land they lived on, 'that I can hardly feed these children?'" Oprah asks, "How did you respond?" Melinda Gates says, "When I first started, I wanted to turn away, to say, 'I'm here to talk about vaccines, not birth control.' It took me a while to absorb the urgency of it." Oprah asks, "When you brought it to Bill's attention, what was his take?" Melinda responds, "Bill is very data-oriented, which is a huge gift. But when I raised the subject with him, he said, 'Melinda, contraceptives are stocked in.' When I looked at the reports, I saw that, yes, most of the clinics were well supplied with condoms because of HIV and AIDS. But as women all over the developing world have told me, they cannot negotiate condoms, even in their own marriages, because that would be like suggesting their husbands have been unfaithful and may be infected with HIV, or that they, the wives, had been." Oprah says, "When a woman can't control the size of her family, it can leave her feeling desperate. You've met mothers who are so beaten down, they've asked you to take their children." Melinda Gates responds, "Yes, like the time I was visiting a clinic in northern India and met Mina, who just had another child. She was breastfeeding him as we spoke." Oprah responds, "You were having a lovely conversation until you asked her if she wanted more children." Melinda Gates says, "All of the sudden, she casts her eyes down and was silent. I thought I'd made a faux pas, but eventually she looked at me and said, 'I can't have more children. I don't have any hope for the ones I have. Their only chance is if you take them home with you.' That crushed me." Oprah responds, "Somebody says, 'Take my 2 boys. What do you say to that?" Melinda says, "I begged her forgiveness. I told her I was sorry, but I had 3 children at home. I just couldn't." Oprah says, "But that was a turning point. You began to see every wall as a door." Melinda says, "She spoke a harsh truth, which took courage, and her pain burned its way into me. I finally really heard what so many women had been telling me. There was a wall that needed breaking down so we could walk through it together." Oprah says, But even after you got it, you worried about the controversy you'd get drawn into with conservatives and Catholics and people who thought you should just stay out of it. Melinda says, the church tells you, thou shall not use contraceptives. But I had to remind myself that my kids are 3 years apart, so obviously I'm using them. When I dug deeper, I found that the vast majority of Catholic women in the U.S. use birth control. And in any case, would I really let people die because of a religion I was raised in? Oprah said, and then you had to find the courage to lead on the issue. Melinda Gates responds, yes, it meant taking a public position and saying, I use contraception. I have sex with my husband. I had to find the strength to be open and to stand on behalf of other women. Oprah responded, and you were moved to act by letting in their pain. Melinda Gates says, yes, it is so important to let my heart break. Oprah responds, I've been one of those people who wants to resist the heartbreak you're describing, to push it away. But if you let your heart break and allow that to guide you to action, you can create a moment of lift. Melinda Gates responds, you have to let it move through you and eventually metabolize. And then you ask yourself, what action is this calling me to do? Oprah responds, it called you to raise $2.6 billion and launch a global coalition on family planning. On page 173 of the book, you write, the starting point for human improvement is empathy. Everything flows from that. I agree with you. We're also disconnected, and it's chipping away at our humanity. It's at the root of so many problems. Melinda Gates responds, empathy leads to listening, and listening leads to understanding. Oprah says, you mentioned wanting to be an example for your children. How do you raise kids who are responsible and kind, who grow up with a sense of grace and yet have their own ambition, when they have access, literally, to anything they want? I grew up poor. When my mother said we couldn't afford something, I knew we couldn't. But you can never say that to your kids. Melinda Gates says, I've wrestled with that. But just because you can get it for them doesn't mean that you should. Our kids see Bill and me work very hard. We don't have to, but we do. Every single day. They've also been fortunate to travel from early ages. They've slept right next to us in goat huts and poor villages in Tanzania. Walked miles to fetch water, cut wood with dull machetes. Learned that a farmer's pig is how he'll pay for his son's education. They see how others live, and they know that they're lucky to be who they are and to have grown up in the United States. Oprah asks, what is your hope for your children? Melinda Gates responds, to find whatever it is that is their talent and use it on behalf of the world. Oprah says, instead of making New Year's resolutions, you choose a single word to bring you guidance for the next 12 months. For example, you've chosen gentle to help you fight perfectionism. You've also picked spacious as a reminder to make room for the things in your life. In 2018, it was grace to signify that you're part of something bigger than yourself. Do you have a 2019 word? Melinda Gates responds, I do. I have to say it feels very vulnerable to share this. It's shine. Oprah says, ah. Melinda Gates responds, it's not about me. It's about believing that every person has a light inside them. Every single person. If we can turn those lights on behalf of women, on behalf of those who don't have as much as we do, on behalf of minorities in their own country, and stand up for what's right, we will break through. We'll all shine. The world will shine. All around the article, there are pictures of Melinda Gates. In the top left-hand corner of the article, there's a picture of Bill and Melinda Gates, and they are surrounding their three children. They have two daughters and a son. And there's a quote down at the bottom of the page that says, faith in action to me means going to the margins of society, seeking out those who are isolated and bringing them back in. I was putting my faith into action when I went into the field and met the woman who asked me about contraceptives. And that was a quote from Melinda Gates in her book, The Moment of Lift. On the next page, there's a picture of Melinda Gates, and she's surrounded by eight women, some holding babies. And it says, Gates meets with the members of the Young Women's Self-Help Group in Kola Village, Uttar Pradesh in India, March 2016. And there's another picture of Melinda Gates surrounded by several women, and she looks like she's showing them something on a computer. And the caption reads, Gates visits Magameni Healthcare Center in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, June 2016. And we will end this installment with a look back to April 2018, the Oh Beautiful section featured a page. It was a bright white page, and the center of the page was taken up with almost a flower design made of different capsules. There are blues and golds and oranges. And the title says, Single and Fabulous. Brew by the cup coffee, microwavable mac and cheese bowls. We are obsessed with one-time use everything. Now you can get your anti-aging products in dosed formulations with serums that contain wrinkle-fighting retinol or antioxidant vitamin C, packaged in tiny capsules that you break open before patting the contents on your skin. These pods stay fresher longer and prevent you from overusing potentially irritating active ingredients, says Mona Gahara, MD, Associate Clinical Professor of Dermatology at Yale School of Medicine. Try Rodan and Fields Redefine Intensive Renewing Serum. That's $99 for 60. RodanandFields.com. Exuviance AF Vitamin C20 Serum Capsules. $69 for 60 at exuviance.com. Or Nigella Therapy Perfecting Night Serum. $69 for 30. NigellaTherapy.com. Now we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope that you've enjoyed it. I'm Liz Elliott, sitting in for Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138.